Instead of saying, given A, B must hold, we ought to say, given A, B must follow. Ambiguous sentence structures like, if A, then necessarily B, seduce many people into overlooking this elementary but vital distinction and committing the Doris Day fallacy. You remember the movie in which Doris Day sings, Que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be. Armed with the proposition that, if A holds, then A must hold, some very distinguished philosophers have argued that all truths whatever are truths of logic, so that the apparent distinction between two is larger than one and Jupiter is larger than Venus is illusory. Others have argued against free choice, saying that if Jones chooses X, then necessarily Jones chooses X, and if he chooses it necessarily, then he does not choose it freely, and so does not choose it at all. Still other philosophers, as we have seen, argue that if God knows today that X will happen tomorrow, then it is true today that X will happen tomorrow, and that this means that X must happen tomorrow, and so all is fated and predetermined. But once we remember to watch out for the Doris Day fallacy, all these arguments collapse. In summary, then, we have three possible answers to the assertion that divine foreknowledge precludes freedom. The first, from Boethius, is that God does not foreknow things because his acts of knowledge are undated. The second, from Aristotle, is that present statements about future choices or their results have indeterminate logical status, and that to know the truth in such instances is simply to know that the statement in question is indeterminate. The third, from Alfred Hitchcock, is that the whole question is a semantic pseudo-problem, an instance of the Doris Day fallacy. Dr. Brandon says, to gather one's knowledge by a process of struggle and effort is abhorrent to the mystic. The concept of omniscience is a psychological monument to the mystic's hatred of effort. I am puzzled by this remark. It seems to say that it is unwholesome to dream of anyone's knowing things without effort. But clearly this is not its meaning, since that would be an attack on Miss Rand. On pages 92 to 94 of Atlas Shrugged, we read, quote, Francisco could do anything he undertook, he could do it better than anyone else, and he did it without effort. No matter what discipline was required of him by his father's exacting plan for his education, no matter what subject he was ordered to study, Francisco mastered it with effortless amusement. Dagny and Eddie spent their winters trying to master some new skill in order to astonish Francisco and beat him for once. They never succeeded. When they showed him how to hit a ball with a bat, a game he had never played before, he watched them for a few minutes, then said, I think I get the idea. Let me try. He took the bat and sent the ball flying over a line of oak trees far at the end of the field. Close quote. If I were as ill-disposed toward objectivism as Dr. Brandon is toward theism, I would quote a series of such passages and say, the portrayal of the character of Francisco d'Anconia is a psychological monument to the objectivist's hatred of effort. But I won't. Dr. Brandon says, if God is all good, then he is not free to be bad, and so his actions have no moral significance, just as the actions of a robot have no moral significance. By Dr. Brandon's definition of free will, as quoted above, an agent is free if it can perform actions not determined by antecedent factors or conditions, by forces outside its control. But there are no factors antecedent to God, who has no cause. All his actions originate with him. They are, therefore, by Dr. Brandon's own criterion, free and morally significant. Surely there is a certain perverseness in the suggestion that the more trustworthy, the more reliable someone is, the less he exhibits good moral character by his trustworthiness, and that someone who can be trusted unconditionally is by that very fact seen to be morally worthless. One is reminded of Professor Peikoff's altogether just strictures against those philosophers who say that the truths of logic and mathematics are void of factual content and furnish no information except about the speech habits of those who use them. He says, quote, the ultimate results of the analytic-synthetic dichotomy is the following verdict pronounced on human condition, on human cognition. If the proposition represents knowledge which is certain, then it does not represent knowledge of reality. If a proposition is conclusively demonstrated so that to deny it is obviously to endorse a logical contradiction, then, in virtue of this fact, the proposition is written off as a product of convention or arbitrary whim. This theory represents a total epistemological inversion. It penalizes cognitive success for being success. Just as the altruist mentality penalizes the good for being the good, so the analytic synthetic mentality penalizes knowledge for being knowledge. Just as, according to altruism, man is entitled only to what he has not earned, so, according to this theory, a man is entitled to claim as knowledge only what he has not proved. Close quote. The quotation, incidentally, is taken from Professor Leonard Peikoff's thought-provoking article, The Analytic-Synthetic Dichotomy, printed in 5 parts in the May through September 67 issues of The Objectivist. I shall cite it hereafter simply as Professor Peikoff's article. Just as the philosophers of whom Professor Peikoff complains stand epistemology on its head, so Dr. Brandon stands ethics on its head by saying that if God is completely good, then he is not good at all. An alternative analysis of Dr. Brandon's assertion is that offered by negative theology, of which more later. Having argued that God cannot be omnipotent and that he cannot be good, Dr. Brandon now undertakes to show that it is even more awkward to suppose that he is both at once. If God is both good and omnipotent, why is there evil in the world? I reply as follows. To raise this question implies that there is some better state of affairs than the one we have, such that God, if he is good, would have preferred it, and God, if he is omnipotent, could have brought it about. Now, does Dr. Brandon have such a state in mind, and if so, what is it? Obviously, the world would be a better place if men chose to make it such. The consistent practice of rationality, justice, and benevolence by all men would considerably reduce the amount of pain and suffering in the world. Shall we say that God ought to have made all men such that they would choose to behave better? But determining men to choose certain things freely is a contradiction. Shall we say that God ought to have made men without free will and hence without the possibility of doing wrong? But beings without free will, according to Dr. Brandon, are incapable of doing right either. Their actions have no moral significance, and their thoughts no rational significance. As Dr. Brandon said in a passage already quoted, quote, "The very concept of logic is possible only to a volitional consciousness." Close quote. I do not think that Dr. Brandon would want to abolish freedom from the world, even if he could abolish pain and evil at the same time. What about other possibilities? Suppose that God permitted men to choose as they pleased, but intervened to prevent their choices from having any untoward consequences. I cannot see that that involves any real choice at all. It is like having a free election, in which the voters may pull any lever they please, but only the lever for the party in power is connected to anything. Perhaps the complaint is not that people can hurt themselves, but that they can hurt others. We might accept a world in which people suffered the consequences of their own irrationality, but it seems unfair that A should be penalized because B is malicious or stupid. But note that a world in which no action of my neighbor's can leave me worse off than if he had chosen otherwise is also a world in which no action of my neighbor's can leave me better off than if he had chosen otherwise. The proposed world is one in which no one can offer any benefit or assistance to anyone else, in which no one can accomplish anything of any significance to anyone else, in which gratitude, friendship, and significant relations between persons are unknown. That this would be a better world than ours is not obvious to me. Some people do, in fact, like the idea of living completely independent, solitary lives. If they had planned the universe, everyone would have his own planet. If you are convinced that this would be better than the present arrangement, then you have in hand an argument against the goodness of God. I doubt, however, that Miss Rand or Dr. Brandon will take this line. Miss Rand has publicly stated that the achievement of which she is proudest is having married Frank O'Connor. Dr. Brandon's writings on romantic love are sufficient evidence of the positive value he attaches to personal relationships. My first point, then, is about the problem of evil, is concerned with free will, and if this is accepted, the problem becomes less formidable. As Dr. Brandon says in tonight's lecture, quote, "Disasters are the exception, not the rule, in man's existence. Most of them are man-made and man-caused. And as to the purely physical dangers and calamities, well, if it were true that physical nature was basically set against man, that the chances of catastrophe were greater than the chances of success, insurance companies would go broke instead of making the fortunes which they do make. Close quote. I therefore invite you, faced with any instance of evil, to ask the question, would this evil still be here if every human had always acted rationally and morally? Only in those instances where the answer is a confident affirmative does the problem of evil require a further answer. Quite apart from the free will argument, it is possible that adversity sometimes builds character, or that a world without pain or danger would be a world in which heroism is impossible. Before dismissing this notion as heartless, I wish that you would try an experiment. Take your copy of Atlas Shrugged and go through it carefully, crossing out or rewriting every passage in which one of the heroes of the book is described as suffering any kind of physical or mental discomfort. Then read the revised work and form a judgment of the novel as a novel and of its heroes as heroes. The notion that there is no heroism without courage, no courage without danger, and that heroism is a better thing than safety, is not merely a notion invented by a handful of theologians to defend the goodness of God with. Some people say, admittedly, heroism is a good thing in a world that has pain and danger in it, but it is good only in such a world. Far better to have neither heroism nor the need for it. To excuse pain and danger because they provide the opportunity for heroism is like praising smallpox, an evil, because without it we wouldn't have smallpox vaccine, a good. For my present purposes, it is enough to show that Dr. Brandon could not possibly endorse this objection. Consider the following remarks in tonight's lecture. Quote, heaven, as their dream of a perfect existence, is a place where men will live in total passivity, where no choice, no action, no thought will be necessary, where everything will be provided for them and everything will be taken care of, where they will experience automatic happiness without lifting a finger or stirring a single brain cell, which they will no longer have to have. It is the same kind of ideal as the Garden of Eden, which the mystics project as the utopia man has lost in punishment for the sin of disobedience, for acting on his own judgment. Heaven is the projection of a state of existence that would be unbearable to any human being to the exact extent to which he was human, meaning rational. It is a state of total stagnation, where no choices, and therefore no purposes, and therefore no achievements would be possible. Only a confirmed parasite could desire such a state as an ideal fulfillment, a parasite who does not mind seeing himself as a contented cow, an ethereal contented cow. Heaven is the dream universe of non-effort. Close quote. The question, instead of giving us the strength to overcome obstacles, why didn't God just give us a world without obstacles, is a possible question, but not for an objectivist. Finally, some people say, if creating a world involved the risk of so much pain and evil, a good God would not have created it at all. To this I reply, if you could annihilate yourself and the whole universe by pushing a button, would you? The implied answer of some philosophers is, I would blister my finger pushing that button. But they are not objectivist philosophers. To anyone using the atheist proof from evil, we may reply, just what is the sort of world that you think a good omnipotent God would have created instead of this one? A world with no wrong choices and no volitional consciousness? A world with no possibility of coercion and no concept of justice or rights, no significant interpersonal contacts? A world with no danger and no heroism? No world at all? Blank out. Thus far, we have considered demands for general improvement of the universe. Some people have advanced demands for particular improvements. They concede that a program to eliminate all evil runs into complications, but they see no excuse for God's letting certain things slide. Thus, the science editor of the London Daily Worker, Professor J.B.S. Haldane, writes, it would have been much more practical to have the windpipe in back of the esophagus, and one would have expected God to put it there. I admit that the proposed change sounds efficient, but I should like to reserve final judgment until I can examine a working model. Obviously, we cannot undertake to evaluate all arguments of this sort, but I should like to make two general comments on them. To say that God is all good does not in any way imply that he regards human comfort as a value to be preferred above all others. We may go further and say that we have no grounds for supposing that he regards human welfare as a value to be preferred above all others. There may, for example, be created beings of volitional consciousness in the world other than humans, and their welfare may sometimes conflict with ours in ways that are not at all obvious to us. And, quite aside from Martians, dolphins, and leprechauns, aside from conscious creatures altogether, there may be quite a number of things in the world that God is interested in, even though we are not. We cannot calculate all the consequences of a given action, and may therefore sometimes be mistaken about whether that action would result in an overall improvement of the state of things. If there is anything in the ecology controversy that should be uncontroversial, it is this, that altering the environment often has results that no one on either side anticipated. And because we do not know as much about the causal workings of the world as God does, it follows that some things we see will look pointless and foolish to us. If I am watching Bobby Fischer play chess, I expect that many of his moves will look like serious mistakes to me. If after every move I found myself nodding and saying, "Ah, yes, precisely the move that I would have suggested. I rather thought he would do that," it would be a sign that he was no better a chess player than I. I am not surprised to find Bobby Fischer a better chess player than I, or God a better cosmos designer. In considering all these points, I ask you to remember that in this part of the discussion, Dr. Brandon is trying to prove that there exists a procedure not involving self-contradiction that a good, omnipotent creator could have followed that would have guaranteed, independently of the choices of free created agents, a better world than this. The burden of proof is therefore on him, not me. I do not have to take every instance of evil in the world and show that it is entailed by a greater good. If I find that I can reconcile cancer with the goodness of God only by supposing that viruses have free will, I do not have to convince Dr. Brandon that they do. He has to prove that they don't, or fall back on calling my position outside the mainstream of modern medicine, which is a somewhat weaker epithet than contradictory. Dr. Brandon says that belief in the goodness of God is immoral in that it causes us to acquiesce in all kinds of evil, but it does not require me to acquiesce in any evil that I am able to prevent. If I am in a canoe just above Niagara Falls, I do not at once assume that it is God's will that I perish. I try to paddle for shore, or for a rock that I can leap out and cling to, or an overhanging branch, or whatever. If the shore is too far away, and there are no suitable rocks, no overhanging branches, and no paddle, then my religion advises me to relax and enjoy the ride. And Dr. Brandon's advice on facing danger, in tonight's lecture, seems to amount to pretty much the same thing. If anyone has a better idea, let me know. Next, Dr. Brandon speaks harshly about negative theology, the doctrine that no predicates whatever can truly be applied to God. He says that in this doctrine we see the real purpose of theism, quote, "the hatred of man's mind and the desire to destroy it, to destroy all the cardinal concepts of man's reason, to destroy the base of man's consciousness, the law of identity, and to leave man on his belly as an abject idiot." Close quote. Negative theology isn't very popular in my circles either. However, I am not persuaded that it is as irrational a venture as Dr. Brandon makes it out to be. It started out not with theologians meditating on the nature of God, but with philosophers meditating on the nature of ordinary physical objects and the language we use to describe them. We say, for example, that water is wet. I may also say, coming out of the shower, that my hair is wet. But these two objects are not wet in quite the same way. My hair is sometimes dry, but water is never dry and cannot be dry. My hair is wet because of its contact with water, whereas water is wet because, well, because it is water. It is the nature of water to be wet. Trying to put the distinction more neatly, I may say that water is not wet, that water is wetness itself. My hair has the property of wetness, and here the property is separable from the object, my hair, in imagination, and will soon be separate in fact. But the water and its wetness are apparently inseparable. The object and its property are one. The water is not wet, i.e., it does not have wetness. It is wetness. Once I accept this as more satisfactory than my earlier naive notion that the word wet has the same meaning in the sentences water is wet and my hair is wet, I naturally start applying this principle in as many other ways as possible. If I think of fire as a substance, and most people do until they become fairly sophisticated about chemistry, then I will say that fire is not hot, but is the cause of hotness in other things. I will note that people speak of visible light, but I will say that light is not really visible. We do not see light. We see tables and chairs by means of light. Material objects are visible. Light is visibility itself, the cause of visibility in other things. If I believe in God, I will eventually get around to saying that God is not good, but is goodness itself, not wise, but wisdom itself, and so forth. On this view, God is the cause of goodness in other things, but not himself properly described as good, although it does no harm to call him so in casual speech, just as most philosophers call a fire hot in casual speech. Sometimes the terminology used is that a soaked object is formally wet, whereas water is eminently wet. That this is not the best way of talking about God, or about water for that matter, may very well be true. But that it is all part of a sinister plot to destroy the mind, I doubt. Faced with Dr. Brandon's complaints that God is not free to be bad and is not knowable, a negative theologian might reply, "You are right in saying that God is not good, since he is not potentially bad. To be wet means to be potentially dry. But there are different ways of not being wet. A shirt fresh from the dryer is not wet because it is dry. A prime number is not wet because the concept of wetness and dryness is not applicable to it. And water is not wet because it is wetness. You might say that none of the three hits the target of being wet, but that the shirt falls short of the target, the prime number is not aimed at the target, and water is the target. Just so, a murderer, a robot, and God are none of them good, but for the same three different reasons. As for knowing God, of course God is not knowable, not intelligible. He is intelligibility itself, knowledge itself, the ground or source or cause of knowledge and intelligibility in other things. If there were no God, if our minds were the product, ultimately, of accident, then no one could know anything. We believe that God exists, not because we have grasped all the implications of that statement, but because his existence is a prerequisite of our grasping anything. We believe in light, not because we can see it, in fact we cannot, but because we can see everything else." Up to this point, Dr. Brandon has been arguing that theism is meaningless, irrational, immoral, and patently false. He now turns to demolish three traditional arguments for theism, the first cause argument, the argument from design, and the argument from life. Before I begin to consider them, I warn you that I am not going to attempt a full-fledged defense of any of them. I consider that I have already given a valid proof and that one valid proof of a theorem is enough. My only purpose is to show that Dr. Brandon has dismissed them too lightly. The best known statement of the first cause is that of St. Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologiae. It may be summarized as follows. "About us we see causal series, with Z caused by Y, Y caused by X, and so on. But Aristotle has shown that a causal series must have a first member. See Aristotle for details. Therefore, there must be an entity A which causes something but is not caused by anything. Such an entity we call a first cause." Three questions present themselves. 1. Why must a causal series have a beginning? 2. What does a first cause have to do with God? And 3. Has Dr. Brandon refuted this argument? To the first question, one answer sometimes offered is that action presupposes an entity that acts, and that an intermediate cause does not act, it merely transmits the action of some previous entity. It is a conduit of action, and a conduit, regardless of length, is no substitute for a source. Or again, it is said that an infinite regress of intermediate causes is like an infinite regress of intermediate values. Suppose that a blacksmith says that a hammer is a valuable object because it can be used to make other hammers. We ask him the point of making other hammers, and he replies that their value lies in their usefulness for making still more hammers. We may surely say that unless some hammer has value either in itself or in its use for some purpose other than hammer making, then no hammer has value at all. A world with only intermediate values is a world with no values. In the same way, a world with only intermediate causes is a world with no causes. Assuming that Aquinas has proved the existence of a first cause, what has that got to do with God? To this question, St. Thomas might reply, "Keep reading, please. There is more to come. Even if you have swallowed the first cause argument, remember that one swallow doesn't make a summa. My one article on the existence of the first cause is followed by 24 articles on what a first cause must be like, and the answer, briefly, is like God." We turn now to Dr. Brandon's refutation of the first cause argument. He summarizes the argument as follows, quote, "Since everything in the universe requires a cause, must not the universe itself have a cause, which is God?" Close quote. He then accuses its adherents of two fallacies. One, they forget that if everything has a cause, then God must have a cause. And two, they forget that, since the universe is the sum of all that exists, it can have nothing outside itself, and so can have no cause outside itself. Now, obviously, Dr. Brandon is not talking about Aquinas' argument at all. Aquinas never assumes that everything has a cause, only that at least one thing does. He does not conclude that there is an entity A that causes the universe, only that A causes something and that there is nothing that causes A. And, of course, the two fallacies that Dr. Brandon complains of correspond to nothing at all in Aquinas. We must conclude that Dr. Brandon has somewhere encountered a quite different version of the argument, and I now conjecture what that version is. Consider the concept of dependence. As we see from the discussion of concepts in Miss Rand's Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, and also in Professor Peikoff's article, this is simply the totality of all things that have causes, that depend for their existence on something outside themselves. Now, the most obvious and fundamental property of this concept, this totality, is that it has a cause. A is A. Existence exists. Consciousness is conscious. Dependence depends. Depends on what? On something other than itself. On independence, autonomy, self-reliance, on the first cause. Now, the word universe, which Dr. Brandon uses to mean the sum of all things whatever, is also used in the narrower sense to mean the sum of all dependent things. See Webster, Oxford, Funken-Wagnalls, or the Random House American College Dictionary. If someone stated the above argument using the word universe in its narrower sense as synonymous with dependence, while Dr. Brandon understood it as synonymous with existence, then his analysis and rebuttal would be dead on target as applied to the argument he thought he was hearing, but completely irrelevant to the argument the speaker intended. When the difficulties of communication are cleared up, Dr. Brandon's two objections simply vanish. And what he would have said to the cleared-up argument we do not know. Therefore, if we wish an objectivist-oriented analysis of the first cause argument, we must construct it ourselves. And first, we must consider what it means to cause something. When we say that the spectacular rise in the price of wheat in 1884 was caused by the eruption of Krakatau the previous year, we mean that the rise would not have occurred if it had not been for Krakatau. To say, correctly or otherwise, that the Battle of New Orleans would have been averted if Napoleon had been killed by a falling meteorite in 1811 is to speak of an alternate possibility, a situation in which Napoleon is killed by a falling meteorite, and the Battle of New Orleans does not take place. Where such an alternate possibility does not exist, we do not talk about cause. No one asks for the cause of the fact that things equal to the same thing are equal to each other, because there is no possibility of their being otherwise. To discuss the cause of X is to say that X would have been different given such and such, which is nonsense unless X could have been different, unless there is a real alternative to X. This analysis of causation, is it sound objectivist philosophy? I submit that it is, and offer a few quotations from Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, as evidence. Quote from Alan Greenspan, Antitrust, page 66. The observable tendency of an industry's dominant companies eventually to lose part of their share of the market is not caused by antitrust legislation, but by the fact that it is difficult to prevent new firms from entering the field when the demand for a certain product increases. Texaco and Gulf, for example, would have grown into large firms even if the original Standard Oil Trust had not been dissolved. Similarly, the United States Steel Corporation's dominance of the steel industry half a century ago would have been eroded with or without the Sherman Act. Close quote. Quote from Nathaniel Brandon, Common Fallacies About Capitalism, page 88. Let anyone who believes that a high standard of living is the achievement of labor unions and government controls ask himself the following question. If one had a time machine and transported the United Labor Chieftains of America plus 3 million government bureaucrats back to the 10th century, would they be able to provide the medieval serf with electric light, refrigerators, automobiles, and television sets? When one grasps that they would not, one should identify who and what made these things possible. Close quote. These statements seem quite clear. In each of them, the author assumes that when something is caused, we can, without nonsense, talk of an imaginary universe in which the cause is absent and the event, therefore, does not occur. In short, he assumes that whatever is caused could have been otherwise. Now, Professor Peikoff, in the article we have cited, considers what it means to say that some event need not have occurred, or that some situation could have been other than in fact it is. He concludes that the only facts that are not necessary, that could have been otherwise, are what he calls man-made facts, meaning facts that result from, are dependent on, were brought about by, the free choice of an agent of volitional consciousness. He says, quote from Part 4, pages 8 and 10, as far as metaphysical reality is concerned, omitting human actions from consideration for the moment, there are no facts which happen to be but could have been otherwise, as against facts which must be. There are only facts which are. A major source of confusion in this issue is the failure to distinguish metaphysical facts from man-made facts, i.e., facts which are inherent in the identities of that which exists, from facts which depend on the exercise of human volition. Because man has free will, no human choice, and no phenomenon which is the product of human choice, is metaphysically necessary. In regard to any man-made fact, it is valid to claim that man has chosen thus, but it was not inherent in the nature of reality for him to have done so. He could have chosen otherwise. Only in regard to the man-made is it valid to claim it happens to be, but it could have been otherwise. Close quote. With these remarks to guide us, let us re-examine the first cause argument. According to Professor Peikoff, whatever could have been otherwise was brought about by the choice of an agent. Please note that when I say choice, I mean free choice, and when I say agent, I mean a being of volitional consciousness, capable of choosing freely. We have now an 11-step argument. This is easier to follow with a blackboard than when it's just spoken, but I'll do my best. Step 1. Let us call an entity temporal if it has a beginning in time, and eternal if it does not have a beginning in time. Then, applying the principle A or not A, found on page 994 of Atlas Shrugged, we conclude that every entity is either temporal or eternal. Step 2. Dr. Brandon, on page 19 of the May 1962 Objectivist newsletter, says, "All emergences of new entities presuppose the existence of entities that caused their emergence. We may therefore say, whatever is temporal is caused." Step 3. As we have just seen in connection with the quotations from Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, whatever is caused could have been otherwise. Step 4. As we have just seen from Professor Peikoff's article, whatever could have been otherwise was brought about by the choice of some agent. Step 5. Since we know that whatever is temporal is caused, whatever is caused could have been otherwise, and whatever could have been otherwise was brought about by the choice of an agent, we may conclude that every temporal entity was brought about by the choice of some agent. Step 6. Since every temporal entity was brought about by the choice of some agent, and everything is either temporal or eternal, then every temporal entity was brought about either by the choice of a prior temporal agent or by the choice of an eternal agent. Step 7. From the previous step, it follows that every temporal entity is part of a causal chain that either A begins with an eternal agent or B includes an infinite series of temporal agents, each caused by a prior temporal agent. Step 8. Dr. Brandon says, on page 19 of the May 1962 Objectivist newsletter, quote, "There cannot be an infinite series of antecedent causes," close quote. We conclude that an infinite chain of temporal agents, each caused by a prior temporal agent, is impossible. Step 9. Since, as we have noted in steps 7 and 8, every temporal entity is part of a causal series that either is infinite or begins with an eternal agent, and an infinite series of antecedent causes is impossible, we conclude that every temporal entity was caused directly or indirectly by an eternal agent. Step 10. In the autobiographical postscript to Atlas Shrugged, Miss Rand says, quote, "I was born," close quote. We therefore conclude that there exists at least one temporal entity, Miss Rand. Step 11. Since every temporal entity was brought about by an eternal agent and Miss Rand is a temporal entity, we may conclude that there is an eternal agent whose free choice is, directly or indirectly, the ultimate cause of Miss Rand's existence. And that concludes my analysis of the first cause argument in the light of objectivist principles. We have not, of course, established very much about this eternal agent, perhaps not enough to justify calling it God. For a full-fledged discussion, we should want to consider uniqueness, benevolence, imperishability, whether the eternal agent is without end as well as without beginning, prudence, meaning whether the eternal agent intends all the consequences of its choices, which many agents obviously do not, and so on. But I shall not pursue this line tonight. As I remarked earlier, I have already offered one proof that I think valid. My only concern with the three arguments that Dr. Brandon cites is to show that there is more to them than meets the eye. More than meets Dr. Brandon's eye, at any rate. Dr. Brandon, commenting on the argument from design, says that the alternative to design, or order, is chaos, which is not really an alternative at all. Every conceivable state of affairs exhibits a pattern simply by being what it is. Let us begin by distinguishing between order and functionality. When we say that we see order in an object or situation, we mean that we see regularity, predictability, conformance to a structure or pattern. When we say that we see functionality in an object or situation, we mean that we see means-end relationships built into the object, that we can say that some features of the object are for something. A salt crystal exhibits order, but not in any obvious way functionality. A watch exhibits functionality in that an intelligent Martian looking at a watch might say, I think I can see what this is for. The hands go around at a constant rate, and the cover is hard so that the hands will not be broken, and transparent so that they can be seen. The geared wheels are there to transmit motion. If they were further apart, they would not mesh, and if they were closer, they would jam. The function of the spring is... and so on. Some people object that any conceivable object does what it does, and so may be said to have parts whose function is to do just that. But in practice, the notion of a functional object seems to be clear to everybody, and everyone seems to understand that an organism, any organism, is a functional object in a sense in which not just any object is. Militantly atheistic professors of biology will say things like, Now, this organ is a bit of a puzzle. Its purpose has not yet been discovered, without realizing that they have said anything remarkable. Now, a natural thing to say about an object that exhibits functionality is that it probably came about by design, i.e., by someone's intention. The Martian examining the watch will say, It looks as if somebody made this to tell time with. The astronomer examining the placing of stones at Stonehenge will say, It looks as if someone built this to make astronomical measurements with. The man observing the eye of the mosquito will say, It looks as if someone designed this for the mosquito to see with. One reply to the argument from functionality, with the argument from life as a special case, is not philosophical but scientific. The stronger the case for Darwinian evolution, the more plausibly this explains how the mosquito got his eye, the weaker the argument from functionality. And vice versa. However, arguments for and against evolution, 1, require specialized knowledge, and 2, can never be conclusive one way or the other. An example of the sort of thing that goes on. The anti-evolutionist says, A reptile has 6 bones in each side of his lower jaw. A mammal has 1. The standard evolutionist account, based on comparative embryology and the like, is that when reptiles evolved into mammals, 3 of the 6 bones moved up and became the bones of the middle ear, 2 disappeared, and 1 remained to form the mammalian jaw. It would greatly ease my mind if you would draw me a series of 10 sketches or thereabouts, showing the intermediate stages in this development, and how each animal was able to eat and hear, and why each stage was a sufficient improvement on the preceding one to have developed from it by natural selection. Never mind going to the museum to look at fossils of the intermediate stages. No such fossils have ever been discovered. But I am reasonable. I do not ask you to show me how it happened, just one of the ways in which it might have happened. If the evolutionist has no plausible reply, then the anti-evolutionist scores a point, which may, however, be taken from him any time that the evolutionist finds a fossil or contrives a sketch. At the end of each round of the debate, we add up the cumulative points on both sides and decide how firmly we will believe or disbelieve the argument from functionality while waiting for the next round. The debate is never really over, and it takes a fair amount of study even to keep up with it, let alone to get involved. Currently, I am not involved.